The iftar, backed by the local council and organised by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters, and also, as Pauline said, to take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that this gathering is taking place during Ramadan, one of the most revered periods in the Islamic calendar, a time not just for abstention and reflection, but to help those who are less fortunate.
Ramadan is a time when we're always thinking about our friends, our family, our neighbours, our community at large. And I think it's one of those moments when we can all gather together, especially after the last couple of years when we haven't been able to do that.
The street iftar party was first organised in June 2017, just days after the terror attack in the Finsbury Park area on Muslim worshippers during the month of Ramadan that cost one man his life and injured nine others. The public iftar was a way for communities to show solidarity and silence hatred with hope.
Tonight, we celebrate. We celebrate the achievements of the Muslim community in this area. We celebrate and thank them for all that they do, and we enjoy a wonderful iftar supper.
This is in memory of our beloved brother Makram Ali, who lost his life in this incident, unfortunately. And we are here. We want to have it every year to, you know, remember what's happened and try to bring communities together after what's happened. And this is the main idea, is to bring us together, to say to those who try to divide us and spread hatred, fear and division that you will not succeed. We are together and we will be always together. Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we should all fight it.
At a time of global disunity, one small corner of North London is showing there is another way. Amina Taylor, London.
The Journalists' Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had doubled the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The French presidential election is being described as a populist bloc of Marine Le Pen versus an elitist bloc of Emmanuel Macron, but many don't seem to want to join either group. The first round's third-place finisher held an internal poll. Almost 70% of his leftist supporters will either abstain or submit blank ballots rather than vote for either candidate. France's Muslims don't see a choice which isn't Islamophobic. Macron continues to support bashing Islamo-leftism, while Le Pen has an on-again, off-again plan to give fines for wearing the hijab in public. The student class isn't taking sides either. They recently blocked universities over what they say are two bad candidates.
The elder class may provide the key vote. Back when he expected an easy victory, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65. Now he's backtracking in an effort to win over left-wing voters, but many aren't sure what his true plans really are.
Le bilan d'Emmanuel Macron n'est pas forcément positif.
Macron's record isn't very positive. Long-term unemployment, economic instability, the destabilizing effects of the yellow vests. People have many different reasons for being disappointed with him.
In 2017, the two mainstream parties were swept out of power, but the repeat second-round matchup has many voters upset that new ideas remain absent.
La ligne conservatrice, réactionnaire.
The conservative and reactionary line is championed by Le Pen, but she's very divisive. Many of her electorate preferred Eric Zemmour in the first round, and then there are many mainstream conservatives who will never vote for her or the National Rally. The key traits of this vote are bitter abstention and bored indecisiveness.
Most polls show Macron leading by around 6 to 8 points, but that's within the margin of error, and Western polls have consistently undercounted the right nationalist candidate. The runoff is on April 24th. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, huh? Because, war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month, if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People in the west of Afghan capital Kabul were once again terrified after three explosions hit an educational center and a high school, leaving dozens of people dead and injured. Soon after the attack, we rushed Abdulrahim Shahid High School to talk with eyewitnesses.
After the first explosion, I arrived at the scene. Then suddenly the next blast hit the school alley. I saw dozens of students fall on the ground. People started to take the dead and wounded to hospital.
The targeted school is located in Hazara's residential area, where the community has been bearing the brunt of Boulogne terror attacks. People are now calling on the Taliban to tighten the security and protect all Afghans.
I call on the Taliban to tighten security across our country and protect those at risk. My sister and her children are living here. They are horrified. I don't want this situation to continue. Besides, we can't dare to send our children to educational centers. When will poor Hazaras live in peace? They have long been falling victim to terrorism.
The Taliban, on the other hand, claim that they won't let such attacks repeat in the future, vowing to bring the orchestrators to justice.
First of all, we extend our sympathy to the families of the victims. Secondly, our intelligence and security forces are investigating the incident and will hold those who martyred our innocent citizens accountable. I promise our Hazara brothers that we will take urgent steps to protect them against our common enemy. We will also pay major attention to the security of their public places.
Last year, at least 58 people were killed and more than 100 injured in a bomb attack in a girls' school in the same Shia neighborhood in Kabul. In recent years, suicide attacks in western Kabul have taken the lives of hundreds of civilians, including students. People here say they're exhausted by growing violence and terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In a Twitter post, the head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdussalam, said since the entry of the UN brokered truce, the Saudi-led coalition has prevented flights from reaching the Sana'a International Airport and obstructed the entry of fuel ships to the port of Hodeidah.
We have entered the third week of the truce while Sana'a Airport has not been opened yet, as it was supposed. Unfortunately, no commercial flight has arrived, even though the airport is technically ready. We do not know what are the reasons that prevent the opening of the airport until now, but what we do know is that the Saudi-led coalition has not adhered to any agreements since the start of its war on our country in 2015.
Observers say the Saudi violations are threatening the UN brokered agreement which is supposed to build for a comprehensive political solution. They are calling on the United Nations to intervene and open Sana'a Airport. In the beginning of April, the UN envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, announced a two-month truce. The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for two flights per week and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hodeidah Port.
For 7 years of war and siege, the United Nations has always been providing the political cover-up for Saudi Arabia's violations of international law. But now that it has brokered an agreement, it should take real measures to force Riyadh to do its part of the truce and open Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. Military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the Palestinian embassy before declaring he was with Palestine. Liberating Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has become a struggle for all resistance factions, as it is linked directly to the Palestinian cause. They stress that liberating prisoners can only be realized completely by liberating Palestine. Officials of Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad considered that history has proven that only armed struggle can be a path to liberating both Al-Quds and the prisoners who continue to suffer from Israel's aggressive policies. More than 4,400 Palestinian prisoners are currently held in Israeli jails. Minors and women are among 500 detainees under the so-called administrative detention policy, under which they are held without charge or trial for an indefinite time period. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Italians have slammed Israel's continued pursuit of repressive, violent practices against Palestinians following the killing of several Muslims, including a teenage boy, by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a major holy site in Al-Quds, last week. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians have been running high over the past weeks, with Israeli forces carrying out numerous raids in the West Bank, which led to the deaths of a number of Palestinians. The latest round of violence by Israel on Monday saw its soldiers forcing their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and removing worshippers from its courtyards in order to allow settlers to exclusively mark the Passover holiday into the compound.
Once again, during Ramadan, a new aggression against Palestinians by the Israeli regime. This time they caught off guard men, women and children who were praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This again has shown the nature of the Israeli regime and the complacence of the international community.
Last year, during Ramadan, similar violence broke out, sparking the biggest conflict in years between Palestinian resistance movements and Israel, an 11-day war which only ended following intervention by international mediators. The violence against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds came at a particularly sensitive time. Ramadan this year coincided with the Christian Holy Week, which ends today, Monday, the second day of Eastertide. Catholic faithful have strongly condemned the latest killing of Palestinians by Israeli security forces.
For the umpteenth time, it is a provocation by Israel. This action were just a fresh provocation. There is a lack of respect for others' beliefs. During Eastertime and Ramadan, we have to be more thoughtful.
Tensions. There are due exclusively to Israeli occupation policy. However, the international community seems to have lost interest in the conflict. By not taking any side, the Italian government is supporting Israel in practical terms.
Last meeting between Italian and Palestinian authorities took place in December when Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki met his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio on the sidelines of the 7th edition of the Rome Med Dialogues Conference. Other than reiterating Italy's traditional support for the Palestinian Authority, Di Maio reaffirmed Italy's commitment to a just, sustainable and negotiated two-state solution between Palestine and Israel as the key to stability and prosperity in the enlarged Mediterranean. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
location on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Spotlight. Tensions are high in occupied Al-Quds as Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Anasa Mosque compound, with scores of Palestinians being injured and arrested. Local sources added that Israeli soldiers fired tear gas and stun grenades as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the international community to restrain the Israeli regime and stop its aggression against Al-Aqsa. Jordanians have also taken to the streets of the capital Amman in solidarity with the Palestinians, demanding the Jordanian government expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Tensions at the holy site began last Friday when Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers during the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joining us from Vancouver. And from Montreal, we have author and journalist Arnold August.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barakat. The Israeli wave of violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa. It continues now for a second week. Give us your perspective on the increase of violence against these worshippers during the month of Ramadan.
So we have been warning that Israel wants to escalate its aggression and atrocities against the Palestinian people in Palestine from the river to the sea, but particularly in Jerusalem, as Palestinians are living the holy month of Ramadan. People are being forbidden from freedom of worship and reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque. Jerusalem, in so many ways, is under siege for many years because Palestinians cannot reach to Jerusalem in order to even visit the city. If you are a Palestinian who lives in the West Bank, you most probably are not allowed to go to Jerusalem unless you get a special permission. And this is nearly impossible for Palestinians in the West Bank, let alone our people in Gaza, who haven't been able to visit Jerusalem for over 20 years. So we're not just talking about these atrocities and crimes that it's happening today. This is a continuation of these Israeli crimes. Now, today, 151 worshippers and Jerusalemites were injured. Three of them are journalists. Ali Yassin, a Palestinian journalist, was shot in the neck. And also two other journalists were shot in the legs. Amongst the injured are children and elderly and three paramedics. So obviously Israel wants to turn the conflict into a religious conflict. This Israeli current government and the previous governments always try to utilize religion as a the scene of the conflict and the reason of the conflict. This definitely serves the interests of Zionists and the Israeli government.
Over to Mr. August in Montreal. In continuation, following up with what our guest just said, Mr. Barakat, another guest that we spoke to here said that what is currently happening at Al-Aqsa Mosque is clearly due to provocation by extremist Israeli settlers. Our correspondent, a Ramallah correspondent that we spoke to earlier, in the program today said that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of space and time. What do you see behind this latest wave of Israeli aggression?
First, I'd like to thank you very much for having me once again. I agree with what the previous speaker said, that this is an ongoing aggression of annihilation that's been going on for several decades. Now, what is new now, according to what you just said, that Hamas, of course, have taken a stand calling for everyone in the world to take aim against the Israeli aggression, the Israeli strikes at this time, and I fully agree with it. Like, why now? Is it possibly tied to the international situation whereby the United States and its ally Israel have been losing some ground among several countries in the global south that refuse to follow the U.S. policy of sanctions against Russia? Now, as we speak, and this is unfolding, I'm wondering, what will Saudi Arabia say with regard to the latest clashes, aggressions, rather, that are taking place at this time. Because if we call, and we discussed this in this program previously, on one occasion, Saudi Arabia refused to respond to Biden's phone call with regards to the need for Saudi Arabia to provide more oil to the United States. And in a recent meeting of the G20, I believe, only one or two days ago, many countries in the north, such as the United States and Canada, walked out of the room arrogantly when the Russian diplomat spoke. But who did not walk out? Saudi Arabia. Not a few commentators in the international press, including the corporate press, have pointed this out. Is this leading to a new situation, and that now the United States will find it more difficult to rally their traditional partners, such as Saudi Arabia and even Jordan, in support of the latest atrocities being carried out by the United States and Israel against Palestine? I could not help but watch a video. It's not the first time, but a video taken about 24 hours ago in Israel, in which you have young Israelis chanting, "Death to the Palestinians, death to the Arab people." So, you know, one has to face the fact, Israel is a fascist society. It is not just the government. Yes, they have the responsibility. But over the years, the Zionists have fashioned and has developed Israel into a fascist society. And that's what Palestinians are up against. And thus the importance for people all over the world to take a very strong stand against Israel, and in my view, in support of the resistance of the Palestinian people.
Khaled Barakat, Jordanians have taken to the streets of the capital Amman in solidarity with Palestinians. The protesters say the Jordanian government must expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also called on the international community to restrain the occupying Israeli regime and stop its aggression against Al-Aqsa. Why aren't we basically seeing more international action right now? Sanctions, suspending of ties, banning athletes and sports teams, and similar measures that so many countries have shown Russia for the war in Ukraine?
Well, that's a very important question. And in the case of Jordan, the vast majority of people in Jordan are against the Israeli occupation and also against their government stance. They know that the regime of Jordan is a puppet to the United States. They know that the regime of Jordan have a cooperation, military and security and political cooperation and economic cooperation with Israel. Jordan basically allow Israel to steal Palestinian natural gas, and they buy it, Jordan and Egypt. Let's remember there is a natural gas deal that was signed just last year for $15 billion between these countries. And this is a stolen Palestinian gas. Jordan also, let's remember that the vast majority of people in Jordan are Palestinians. There are over 5 million Palestinian that compromised, you know, composed the vast majority of the people in Jordan. And so immediately, whenever escalations happened in Palestine, on Palestinians in Jordan are the first to react. But also on the question of sanctions, we have been seeing also a high and a rise in solidarity with Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. I mean, just in Canada in the last month, there are four student societies in major universities in Canada voted for sanctions against Israel. And this reflects the notions and the positions of the younger generation in this country. Last week, the student society of Simon Fraser University in British Columbia voted unanimously for the liberation of Palestine and the return of refugees and boycott all Israeli institutions. We see that Israeli atrocities, in one hand, are crimes against our people in Palestine, but we also see that there is a popular reaction more engaged in publicly support Palestinian resistance and Palestinian armed resistance. So this also speaks to your questions of the resistance positions in Gaza. Gaza are also the Palestinian resistance movement are sure. united, and they are also ready to be engaged in any confrontation if Israel escalates more.
Arnold August, following up on that that notion, how do you explain the clear inconsistency of the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestine?
Well, the short answer to that is the following. The United States, the actual worst terrorist, international terrorist in the world, the worst violator of human rights in the world since the end of the Second World War, they, of course, have never been sanctioned for anything, even if they are responsible for the killing and maiming of millions of people, especially in the Middle East and elsewhere. But I would like to follow up on what the previous speaker said, because it's a very positive thing. For example, in the West, such as in Canada, there is an increased movement in Canada to support the Palestinian struggle. For example, in my own alma mater, where I graduated in 1970, McGill University in Montreal, the student body there, in a referendum, voted overwhelmingly to support the struggle of the Palestinian people against Israel. But guess what happened? The administration, which is, by the way, Zionist infected right from 1970s when I was there to the actual situation today, they have actually been carrying out repression against the student bodies for having called that referendum and having voted positively in support of the Palestinian people. And in response, this coming Monday, there's an important demonstration taking place right in the center of Montreal, facing McGill University, to support the McGill students and also the faculty who are taking a stand against Israeli occupation, including the current latest Israeli atrocities that are being carried out against the Palestinians. These atrocities, no one can miss it, even on the corporate media. We see it every day.
Khaled Barakat, there were a number of reprisal attacks against Israelis over the past week. Some were even in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these attacks, which were praised as heroic reprisal attacks in response to the Israeli regime's crimes and occupation.
Well, these actions are a natural Palestinian resistance action against the occupation, atrocities, and crimes. Palestinians are going to continue their resistance until they liberate their land. I mean, in Gaza, we have a very disciplined and organized resistance. It has a central command and ability to engage in resistance in a different fashion than resistance in in the West Bank or inside 1948 occupied territories or what they call Israel. And these actions are going to escalate, in my view. I think that the situation in Palestine are heading towards escalation. I think also that the international scene is shifting slowly but surely for the benefit of Palestine. Today in the region, there is a very strong resisting camp, particularly the position of Iran, Hezbollah, the Palestinian resistance, the Iraqi and Yemeni resistance. So our region is witnessing two camps, two projects, a project of domination led by the United States and its puppets in the region, particularly Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Israel, and another camp that is led by Iran and the resistance movement, and a popular movement, but it's also a camp of resistance that is international and not just in the region. And this is, in my view, is putting Palestine right in the center. And it's important for the Palestinian people to be united at this time in order to be able to resist and fight and stand. This is a phase of steadfastness. and not a phase of, achieving fast victories. It is a phase of accumulating the strength of the resistance in the region. And that's the only way that we are going to liberate our region from imperialism, colonization, and reactionary regimes.
Mr. August, let's talk about the normalization deals. Palestinians have condemned these agreements as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. There's been a lot of international condemnation. Iran has strongly condemned the Israeli attacks at Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying the regime has become more aggressive as a result of some Arab rulers abandoning the Palestinians and their cause. Have these Arab governments, in your opinion, turned a blind eye to the suffering of their Arab brethren? And has that emboldened the Israelis even more?
Yes, I agree with the analysis being presented. There's no doubt about it. The so-called normalization, which is in fact another polite, diplomatic, but hypocritical term for the actual full alliance, full alliance by these Arab states to the U.S.-Israeli policy, whose goal is to annihilate the Palestinian people. There's no doubt about it. And of course, yes, the United States is emboldened because they managed to get these new agreements going over the last period of time. But I'm not so sure how far they can get away with that. And sure, they've been emboldened to carry out these latest attacks we've seen over the last few weeks for the whole world to see. However, this may result in some countries who even have establish these normalized relations, they may have second doubts and perhaps turn back their initial agreement to develop these normalizing relations. We never know. I hope so, but the world is moving so quickly with regards to Ukraine and now the Middle East that anything could happen. Look what happened in Pakistan. Pakistan took a stand against the U.S., insisting you must import gas and oil from Russia, and the president of Pakistan, who is not a revolutionary, said, we are not your slaves, no. So I think we're living in a new situation. It has its negative sides, for example, the killing that is going on in Ukraine, but it also has a positive side, that people increasingly are seeing the United States as the cause of all the conflicts in the world, including in Ukraine, and hopefully very important in Palestine. And I just hope that the Palestinian governments change their mind and for once take a stand in support of Palestine and against the U.S. and its Israeli puppet regime.
Khaled Barakat, as the Israelis expand ties with some Arab governments, grassroots Palestinian reactions have started to increase, as we discussed earlier. Is this a clear sign from Palestinians showing how they feel about these deals, about Israel trying to legitimize the occupation through these U.S.-crafted normalization deals?
Absolutely. And Palestinians, they have a historical experience with these Arab puppet regimes. We definitely differentiate between the position of the people and the position of the governments. The overwhelming majority of people in the region, and Arab people particularly, is for Palestine, for the resistance against the occupation and colonization, against their governments. But we know that people in Saudi Arabia are not able to express themselves freely. People of Bahrain are being oppressed on a daily basis, killed and jailed and, threatened with their lives and with their families. And so they don't really express freely how they feel and how, despite all of that, we see, for example, in Morocco, in Tunisia, in Jordan, in various different Arab streets, people are engaging. Now, the important point to make here is the Palestinian position is very important in order for the Arab regimes to also, not to go into a full alliance with Israel, as some of them are doing today. And the Palestinian Authority of Ramallah is not doing its job. They are coordinating with Israel on security issues, and they are targeting Palestinian resistance in the West Bank. And so that's why today Mahmoud Abbas approval in Palestine, it's less than 13%, and that's the West Bank. And so the reason for that is because there is a popular position overwhelmingly against these deals. Palestinians consider these deals to be an aggression against their rights and against their future and present.
All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, journalist and activist Khaled Barakat, joining us from Vancouver, author and journalist Arnold August, joining us from Montreal. Thank you for contributing to the show, and also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Samples collected by Chang'e 5 are revealing exciting insights into the moon's evolution. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Smriti Malapati, writer. This article is published under the heading China's First Moon Rocks Ignite Research Bonanza. Stay tuned for more. Until recently, geochronologist Li Xianhua's research focused on molten rocks on Earth. But when a Chinese spacecraft delivered the country's first rocks from the moon in December 2020, Li pivoted to study them. "I am a new person working on extraterrestrial rocks," says Li, who is based at the Institute of Geology and Geophysics, IGG, at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. Li is one of the many planetary scientists in China who have had the chance to study lunar rocks for the first time. The samples collected by the Chang'e 5 spacecraft are the first brought back to Earth since NASA's Apollo and the Soviet Union's Luna missions more than 40 years ago. They are being examined for insight into the moon's evolution. Those studies are starting to yield exciting results. About half a dozen papers have been published on the Chang'e 5 papers in the past 6 months. And last week, at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston, Texas, a session on China's lunar missions saw roughly a dozen studies presented. There are a lot of young Chinese researchers getting involved, says Clive Neal, a geoscientist at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, who has worked on Chang'e 5 samples with collaborators in China. Several postgraduate researchers and students presented work on the lunar samples at a conference in Houston, he says. The rocks are exciting because they represent a window into a very different era of lunar magmatism compared with those gathered previously, says Neil. The Chang'e 5 mission recovered 1.7 kilograms of loose volcanic material called basalt from a vast lava plain known as Oceanus Proclembrum in the moon's northern region. The location was selected partly because it might contain younger volcanic material than the regions visited by the Luna and Apollo missions. The hope was that a younger site would give insight into a time when the moon had started to cool but was still volcanically active. Last July, the China National Space Administration released the first specimens to scientists across China. Some 17.5 grams of the fine-grained powder and solid rock were distributed for 31 scientific projects selected from 85 applications. Several further rounds of applications to work with lunar samples have followed. The first teams rushed to date the moon rocks. On October 7th, one team reported an age of 1.96 billion years, give or take 57 million years for the basalts. Less than 2 weeks later, another team, including Lee, corroborated those dates, estimating the age to be 2 billion years, give or take 4 million years. The results confirmed that the moon was still volcanically active almost a billion years later than the rocks from Apollo suggested this activity peaked. But working out what fuel this activity has proved tricky. One leading theory based on satellite observations suggested that heat-producing radioactive elements such as potassium and thorium found in lunar mantle might have driven the volcanism. But when another team at IGG examined the lunar basalts, they determined that high levels of these elements were not the source. Another possibility was that the mantle contained enough water to reduce the temperature at which materials melt and would make it easier for the magma to erupt. But Lin Yangting, a planetary scientist at the IGG, and his colleagues found that the lunar rocks probably came from a relatively dry source. The question of the volcano's heat source was flummoxed scientists. I have no answer for this, says Lin, who previously studied meteorites found on Earth. Weibo Hsu, a planetary geochemist at Purple Mountain Observatory, CAS, in Nanjing, China, said this is a very big science problem. Hsu, who received two chips of basalt, wonders whether a closer look at these basalts might reveal that they actually do come from a rich source of heat-producing elements, because the recently published study by Lin and his colleagues were conducted on soil samples that contain many materials. Hsu has found that the rocks contain high levels of titanium, which suggests they came from deep in the mantle. For now, theories about the moon's heat source abound. But Hsu says there will be a lot of groups trying to solve the mystery and gain other insights about the moon. He has seen many researchers join the field since the arrival of the Chang'e 5 samples. This year, his lab received more applications from students keen to join their graduate program than they could accommodate. This has never been the case before. Lin expects even more researchers to get involved. Within the next decade, China is planning a sample return mission to the moon's South Pole and another to Mars. Lee says 20 to 30 years ago, this was just a dream. Now it has come true.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.